You're listening to
Sex Gets Real.
Sex Gets Real.
Sex Gets Real.
Sex Gets Real.
With Dawn Sarah.
With Dawn Sarah.
Thanks. Bye.
Hey, everyone. So here we are with this week's episode, and I'm super excited to share that once again, the episode is sponsored by Talkspace, the online therapy company. For as little as $32 a week, you can work with an experienced, licensed therapist handpicked just for you. In fact, when I used them last summer, I specifically said that I needed somebody who was kink aware and trauma informed, and they matched me with someone who was super open to exactly what I needed. On Talkspace, you can send text, audio, and video messages to your therapist and talk about your life, work through what's keeping you up at night, or just work on feeling a bit happier. To sign up or to learn more, there's a super special URL just for Sex Gets Real listeners. So it's super important that you go to Talkspace.com/SGR for Sex Gets Real. And to show your support for the podcast, plus, to get $30 off your first month, you can use coupon code SGR for Sex Gets Real. So again, that's coupon code SGR to get $30 off your first month at Talkspace.com/SGR. This week's episode is one that I'm very excited about. Abortion hasn't been a huge topic on the show, and It's interesting because it's been something that has been a really big part of my life. I personally have not had an abortion. I have supported friends through abortions, through decisions around whether or not to terminate a pregnancy. I worked as an escort at a clinic protecting patients from very aggressive protesters on the sidewalk that were trying to prevent them from going inside, often for things like birth control or for pregnancy support. And I ran a book club for 7 years in Washington, D.C. that was all about reproductive justice. And so I'm just surprised it hasn't played a bigger role in Sex Gets Real to now. But if I had to pick an episode and a person to help me bring this to you in a really interesting, sensitive, nuanced way, I couldn't ask for anyone better than Carol Sanger. I got a copy of her new book about abortion by Harvard University Press. It's one of the most interesting books about the legislative landscape and technology and how that's impacted how we talk about it. One of the most fascinating parts of the book is actually she looked at actual case studies and circumstances where men had the opportunity to decide what would happen to frozen embryos or to a pregnancy when their wife was or partner were in serious medical trauma, and examined the reasons that men gave for deciding to have embryos destroyed. And that's actually where we start with this episode. And it's really fascinating. She looked at imagery all throughout history, and it's a fantastic book. So even if you are unsure of your feelings about abortion, if you have a very complicated understanding of it and complicated feelings, I just want to invite you to join us for this hour. Throughout the episode, there are a number of stories that were offered to me from people who had had abortions. And these stories range from grateful and life-changing in that it offered them a chance to really live out their dreams, to guilt-ridden and very complicated. All of the stories that were provided to me are on sexgetsreal.com/EP162 for this episode. I highly recommend that you go and read all of these stories by the people themselves who experienced abortion. And then I invite you to sit through this hour and to just allow yourself to ask new questions, to absorb the experiences of others, and to see how you feel at the end of it. Carol is delightful and funny and so approachable, despite being so frickin' smart and talented at what she does. So let me tell you a little bit about Carol, and then we will dive into this episode that I am so, so excited to bring you. So Carol Sanger is the Barbara Ehrenstein Black Professor of Law at Columbia Law School. She teaches courses on contracts, family law, and others focusing on reproduction, the legal profession, and law and gender. Her recent book about abortion is centered on the regulation of abortion. I know it sounds like this hour is going to be very heavy, but I promise you it's not. It's fascinating and personal and intimate and interesting, and I think it's really going to give all of us new ways to think about and consider this conversation that, at least in the United States, is a very hot topic. I know a lot of other countries where abortion is legal actually don't have this very pro-life rhetoric issue. But here in the United States, it's a very complicated thing. So I invite you to dive in. Don't forget, you can also support the show by going to patreon.com/sexgetsreal. Even a dollar a month super helps me out so much. And of course, that expanded Dylan episode is coming in a couple of weeks. One other thing I want to mention, and I do talk about this with Carol at the very end of the episode. Throughout the episode, we use very binary language around gender. We refer to people who get abortions as women and a lot of other characters in our conversation and in Carol's book as men. There's a very deliberate reason for that, that we actually talk about. I read a little line that's in the book about why she decided to use binary language, but do note that at the very end of the hour, we talk about trans inclusion, and both of us are very aware that not everyone who gets an abortion identifies as a woman or is a woman. So stay tuned for that too. Here we go. Welcome to Sex Gets Real, Carol. I am over the moon to be having this conversation with you today.
Well, I'm thrilled to be here, and I'm now very glad I know about Sex Gets Real. and all my friends, and everyone said, "What?" And I said, "Yes, it's fabulous." So I'm a converted. Yes.
Oh, excellent. I love that. Well, I just want to tell you, first of all, and of course make sure the listeners hear this too, that your book about abortion is absolutely incredible.
Thank you. When you're working on something, you like to think you're on the right track, but there are bits of it which are a bit, some of are edgier than others, and I just kept going. I'm in a reading and writing group. We read each other's work, and at one point on a chapter on the images of fetuses in art, one of the group members said, "I don't really see what you're doing, but keep going." So that was very good, and I kept going, and it worked out, I think. But yeah, so I really appreciate that, and I'm very pleased that you like it so much, and that you found so much in it.
I did. I have a habit of, you know, underlining things in books and putting little notes in the margin, or kind of like my feeling in the moment as I'm reading that I want to return to. And I know the mark of a good book when I never put my pen down.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Just the entirety of your book from start to finish is filled with underlines and exclamation points and fuck this and oh my God. And I love this. So, yeah, it's great. And I think what's so interesting is, for listeners who don't know, I ran the Washington Pro-Choice Book Club for 7 years. And during that time, Dr. Willie Parker was part of our book club. And I had a chance to read hundreds of books on everything that had to do with reproductive experiences and women's bodies and motherhood and stuff, but lots of books about abortion. And one of the things that really stands out to me about your book is you're not only really kind of looking at the legislative landscape and keeping it really interesting, mm-hmm. also really digging into the power of imagery, the ways that having access to images about what's happening in bodies is changing the conversation. You have one of, I think, the most fascinating chapters in any abortion book that I have ever read, where you use kind of real life examples of when men have an opportunity to choose what happens to an embryo or to a pregnant spouse who maybe is in a coma or is brain dead, and really kind of extrapolate the reasons that men decide to have embryos destroyed and kind of compare that to reasons that women use to choose abortion. And like there's so much in this book that kind of looks farther out than just this very hot, heated topic of abortion specifically.
Well, that I'm glad the father chapter got to you, because I've been just wondering for, 25 years, where are the men in this discussion other than the ones who are sitting around the table with Vice President Pence? I mean, where are the real men who are either accompanying women to an abortion clinic or not accompanying them or ditching out when they find out she's pregnant or agreeing with the decision of a partner? And where are they? And so I thought, what would men do what would men do if they were pregnant? And I thought, that doesn't really get us anywhere, because I think if men were pregnant, they'd be women, and we'd occupy the male role, the male slot, mm-hmm. and so it would just be reversed oppression, possibly.
Yeah.
I'm not. So I thought, but what? So that won't work. Just this pretending. What would men do? So I thought, well, what do men actually do when they have the opportunity to control what happens to an embryo or fetus? And then, since I teach family law, I remember all these frozen embryo cases. And I thought, in many of them, the man is the one who doesn't want it implanted in his ex or in anybody else. And so I scoured the newspaper articles on these cases, because the cases tell you the law, but I wasn't so much interested in the law as what's going on. Why do they want this outcome? And so there was plenty on it, because lots of men were happy to be interviewed, which, bookmark, women are not.
Yes.
So they were, saying all kinds of things to reporters, like, I don't want to spend the rest of my life with that woman, or I have enough kids already, or this is one of my favorites, I'm a young man, now that I'm single again, the last thing I want is to be tied down to a kid. And that is something, you don't hear women say ever. Mm-hmm. Even though, like, taking some enjoyment out of their own life is a good thing. Women know what kind of reasons not to give.
Yeah.
So it was very interesting to me. And the one man also said, I'm engaged in a serious work project right now. It would be very bad to have another kid. So when I lined those reasons up with the reasons that women give, plans, finances are bad, really don't want a relationship with the other person, they were quite the same, except for one thing. Two things, actually. No man said, and I realize I'm very selfish for doing this. and that got me. I thought it was amazing that the kind of reasons men gave were sort of self-regarding reasons, what we call self-regarding. They're doing it for their own best interest. And women, you just leave out the regarding and call them selfish. Mm-hmm. So that struck me hard. And yeah, and the other difference was what I mentioned before, men saying, I don't want another kid because I need to kick up my heels.
Mm-hmm.
So I learned a lot from that. And I also, just to go to the coma business, stumbled onto something I didn't know at all, which is a new thing that's getting enacted in a lot of states, is if a woman has signed a directive, if she goes into coma or is brain dead, no more, let's take the coma first, no heroic measures. And a number of states, and they're doing it increasingly, have passed laws saying that directive has no application if the woman is pregnant.
Wow.
So it's to say, if you no late term, no late pregnancy, no fully developed pregnancy, but any time in a pregnancy, if you are in a terrible accident and are living on life support, and you said you don't want to have your body sustained this way, it's too bad.
God.
Yeah, it's really amazing, and you wouldn't know that. You wouldn't know that exists. So it sort of goes against our ideas about people's control of their bodies in this very fundamental way.
Yes. And I think that's, really quickly, I think that the way that you gave men a voice in this book around why they make decisions was really important, because I think that it, more than anything, highlights just how much these abortion debates and the legislation is about women, in that men can stand up and give these interviews and not be afraid of losing jobs or of being shot for saying, I want these embryos destroyed because I just don't want more children, or I'm really busy right now, or I don't want to have this relationship. And to see that women really have enough evidence in their lives to know, this is important for me to keep a secret.
That's exactly it. I mean, I think it's very hard in the U.S. to have an abortion or to think about having one and want to talk about it with someone. Women are very careful who they talk about it with, because it's perceived to be so stigmatizing. And for men, it's the difference between motherhood and fatherhood, which is not entirely, which is not an equal, those are not equal statuses, because mothers are expected to be altruistic even for their embryos, even for below an embryo, a blastocyst,
Yep.
I found a quote, I hope I have it, because I was looking through the book, and it was from Harriet Beecher Stowe. Mm-hmm. And, it was Julia Ward Howe. And it says, it is a blessed thing to be a mother, but there are bounds to all things, and no woman is under any obligation to sacrifice the whole of her existence to the mere act of bringing children into the world. So I thought, that's pretty good for Mother's Day,
Yes, it is. I loved that quote. That was, of course, one of the ones that I starred in.
Oh, Harvard. Good.
I loved it.
Do you want me to send you a new book?
No, I love my beautifully loved copy.
Okay.
Thank you. And if you don't mind, I would actually, since you're talking about, how women really understand that it's not safe to talk about these things. So many of the abortion stories that I got in my call for stories really touch on the importance of the secrecy. And so if it's okay, I'd love to read one of the things that got shared.
Oh, I would welcome it.
Okay. So this comes from Anonymous, who had her abortion at 27. I knew I couldn't financially support a child. The father was someone I had only recently started dating a few months earlier, and he told me if we had kids and I ever left him, he'd take my children from me and make sure they suffered until I came crawling back. I was unwilling to put my child in that position. I will protect my children at all costs, even if that means not giving birth to them. I have never doubted my decision. It was the right thing to do. At the time, I had recently moved to a state where it's very difficult and very expensive to get an abortion. I didn't tell any family or friends beforehand, and only ended up telling my sister and her husband afterwards because I needed their help lifting things that I couldn't carry. My dad and stepmom still don't know. In the last year, I've become more open about it and shared with a few friends and also told my mom. I do not regret the decision. I was protecting myself and the child from a dangerous man.
That is so powerful. Mm-hmm. And I thank the Anonymous for writing, writing in and sharing that, because the idea of protecting your children, even if it means not giving them birth, that's an amazing phrase. Mm-hmm. And, in her case, she knew that, she had this threat, a real threat from the man involved, that was meant to keep her with him all the time. It was like, I'm going to use your children to keep you from ever leaving me. So we see what that is. And it's wonderful that you talked about it in terms of protection. And the studies of women who will talk about why they aborted, there's a lovely article, and it's called "I Would Like to Give My Baby Everything in the World." And she just says, I know what kind of mom I want to be, and I would like to give her everything in the world. And she knew she couldn't, and so she didn't. She had an abortion. But it's another way of putting, we have ideas about how we want to care for our children. One is protection. You know, that's like very basic. And another is to provide for them and not just have them and bring them into a situation that is that the woman knows is going to be harsh,
yeah,
or too difficult, or not the way she wants to raise her children, and we don't give that much credit. In fact, sorry.
Oh no, you go.
Well, one of the phrases that I really picked up from Texas when they were having their ongoing fight with the legislature, they had a bumper sticker called Trust Texas Women. And I thought, trust Texas women. Yes. And then I started thinking, we trust women with everything. We trust them with raising our children. I mean, we assign that task to them. We trust them with everything except deciding that this might not be the right time. Circumstances might not be right. This might be too difficult for the child and for me. So it's conditional trust.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was one of the things that really struck me as I was reading your book was, you know, it's so clear that the assumptions by lawmakers is that women are either ignorant or uncaring, or I think in some cases just stupid. And so the law must forcefully educate and protect them from themselves by having mandatory ultrasounds, which is basically the state forcing access to your body and the antithesis of informed consent. But, you know, that's how we get these forced waiting periods of, if we can show them these pictures, if we can ask them these really invasive questions, if we make them wait 72 hours, then they'll think about it and maybe realize what they're doing. Because the assumption is that women don't understand what abortion is, that women don't understand that there's an embryo or a fetus. And it's this really bizarre thing that, but if they choose to have children, we trust that they understand the lifelong impact that may have.
Right, right.
The other risks that come with being pregnant for 9 months and then raising children. It's this really bizarre disconnect.
Well, you have it exactly right. And it's interesting that you said we're trying to protect women from themselves, since what we were talking about with regard to the letter you received, that woman was talking about protecting her children and herself. And what the legislatures are doing, you put it exactly right. They're trying to protect women from themselves. And the argument goes like this, and this was an argument endorsed by the U.S. Supreme Court. If women knew how terrible abortion is, and in the case that where the Supreme Court said this, it was a late term abortion. If they knew how absolutely horrible the process of an abortion is, they will regret it. There is no reason to doubt they will regret it, you know, for the rest of their lives. And so it is, I'm looking back at your list. You said, are they stupid? Mm-hmm. Are they ignorant? And so it's incredibly paternalistic. And also, it's wrong. I mean, women do know what it means to have an abortion. And I often ask my class, what do you think a woman should be told or has to know before she can consent to abortion? And they brought it down to this. You have to know you're pregnant. And you have to know what pregnancy means. So this would apply to young girls, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, do you understand what this means? And it seems absurd, but I don't that a woman wouldn't. But there was a case in New Jersey where that went all the way to the New Jersey Supreme Court just a few years ago, where the woman went in. She had two children, by the way, and she had an abortion, and it she had to go back to an emergency room later. And the nurse said to her, she said, why am I bleeding so much? And the nurse said, well, your doctor left part of the baby in you. And so she sued the doctor for failing to tell her that by having an abortion, she had killed her own son.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the court didn't permit it. The court said, no, there's no consensus that prenatal life constitutes your relative, you know, your relative as a living child would. Mm-hmm. But that's the view that's creeping around right now, that life begins at conception, protected life begins at conception. Yeah. You know, so we would all agree that life, some kind of life, there is something growing there. And that it's human. Mm-hmm. So to say that prenatal life is human life, that's true, but it's not a person in the sense that we use the word person in law, which yeah. means you're protected in every way. Mm-hmm. I'm laughing to myself because there's a case, where, so what would it mean if a embryo or a fetus were a person? It's a great case. I hope you saw it in the book, where a woman is driving in the high occupancy vehicle yes. lane. And she gets stopped by the police who say, I'm sorry, ma'am, here's your ticket. You're only one person in the car. And she says, no, I'm pregnant. There are two of us here.
We are carpooling.
That's right. We're prenatal carpooling. So she had to pay the ticket.
Yes, as she should.
Yes, yes.
But yet in abortion, it would be a completely different story.
Yeah. You know, when you said that, so how are we going to get women to come around and see the light? And the way we do it is say, okay, you have to have an ultrasound and be asked, do you want to look at the picture of your unborn child, in those words? Or in several states, the doctor has to read out a script to you about prenatal life and development, and then point out to you on the monitor, this is the head. They have to point at the head, extremities, and any organs that are visible. So this is to show you, do you get it now? Do you see that there's this thing there that we're going to call a life? And what's weird is you could show women pictures. I mean, if you felt it was really important to educate them about what a fetus is or looks like at that stage, which is essentially, in most cases, well, it might have a little bit of shape, but most abortions take place around 10 weeks, which is fairly shapeless. Mm-hmm. But pictures won't do. They want you to like look into your own body. So you have the idea is to force some connection with you and this thing on the monitor, which is already, you know, 10 trillion times big. No, it's not the right number, but much bigger than what is actually inside. And in case you didn't get that message, you know, in case you didn't get it from the ultrasound, then Texas, for example, says, and we want you to know before you consent that we require you to bury or cremate the fetal remains.
Yes.
So we're going to continue to personify this entity as human like you or me, by doing a ritual of mourning, you know, by making you go through the kind of procedure you'd go through with a dead person. So they sort of like get you at the beginning and the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a sly game, and nobody doesn't understand what's happening. Nobody thinks, oh, thank God, I can finally understand what I'm doing. The book is called About Abortion, and then it's a colon, and then it says Terminating Pregnancy in 21st Century America. And a number of people said, why did you put abortion, the word, and terminating pregnancy? Aren't they the same thing? And my answer is, no, for just the reason we're talking about. Abortion has all the connotations of killing, selfish, you know, all the things we've been saying. And terminating a pregnancy, it's the difference between a pregnancy and a fetus. Mm-hmm. And, you know, technology has made it possible to know you're pregnant so early. Yeah. And to look inside so early. So we've sort of shifted. We sort of started childhood in the womb.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. So which is partly the result of ultrasound, because you can see something. So technology has been, you know, technology has been a very good service to anti-abortion advocates because they think they have proof.
Yes. Yeah. So I have two stories that are very different from each other, but I think fit in really nicely here around being very clear about why this decision is being made, but having very different feelings about it. And I would love to read the two kind of back to back, and then I think it'll be a really wonderful way for us to transition into talking about loss and regret.
Yes, good.
Okay. So the first one comes from Miranda, who had an abortion at 24. Some of the factors I considered were my ability to financially and emotionally care for a child alone. I had been seeing the guy for a few months casually, but was living at home to deal with my own anxiety disorder and my mom's borderline during a divorce between her and the man who raised me. It was a time in my life when I knew that having a baby would prevent me from healing and getting out of a dark mental place and a dependent financial one. Because of my abortion, I am now happy and healthy, living on my own in another state. I have a great job, great committed relationship, and even better mental health. I can provide a safe living situation for my much younger brother and pursue comedy, improv, and my dreams. I went alone, and only a few people know what I went through, including my current partner. I still feel, though, like I can't share my story because my reason, that I just wasn't ready, isn't good enough. If you're like this person who wrote in, or if you've experienced a miscarriage, abuse, trauma, or you're just feeling super stuck in your life, today's sponsor, Talkspace, which is an online therapy company, makes it really easy to connect with an experienced licensed therapist handpicked just for you. And it's as little as $32 a week. You can text, do audio, do video, whatever you want, even a live video chat. And it's an amazing way to start sharing your stories, processing through some of the things that maybe you've felt ashamed of or stuck around. And that's not a problem at all because your therapist with Talkspace is ready to help. To sign up or learn more, go to my special little URL, talkspace.com/SGR for Sex Gets Real. And as a special offer just for the listeners, you can use coupon code SGR, and that gets you $30 off your first month. That also shows support for the podcast. So as you're listening to this episode, if you have things coming up, if you're feeling triggered, or if you realized your story needs to be heard, reach out to Talkspace. Back to the episode.
That's really powerful. And should we hear the other one first?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So Anonymous had an abortion at 19. Choosing to abort was one of the hardest decisions I ever made. In all honesty, I regret it a lot. I named the child I was carrying and felt a lot of emotional attachment. To me, that's why it was so hard. I have no moral objections to abortion, but having that child was something I really wanted. It became a child rather than a fetus. The moment that I realized this was something I wanted and not feared. But it also wasn't an option. As a sex worker and at the time an addict, carrying that child to term would have killed me. It would have ensured such a loss of income as to leave me homeless and caused me to abandon dependencies I relied on, which likely would have left me suicidal. I still mourn today, 4 years later. But I also made the only choice I could. I hate the abortion narrative as it exists. I feel like my choices are to be fodder for pro-lifers who would have allowed me to carry this pregnancy at the cost of most likely both of our lives, or to abandon all negative feelings to stand with pro-choicers. But the reality is that life is more complicated than that. My life is more complicated than that. I can relate to the pro-lifers' narratives, but I also do not agree with them. Ultimately, I did what I had to do, but not being allowed to express any kind of regret, not being allowed to mourn, that has hurt a lot.
Well, The two read so interestingly together because both women were confident about their decision.
Yes.
Even though the second letter, it's very interesting because she's talking about a wanted pregnancy, mm-hmm. and the line between wanted and unwanted is very thin. And wanted pregnancies can become unwanted when you size things up. Mm-hmm. This person seemed to know all her situation very well from the start. But there are other women who call someone and say, guess what? I'm pregnant. And the man says, well, have a happy life.
Yes. No.
Or you're happy, you're pregnant, and you lose your job. Or your younger brother, as in one of these cases, you know, needs your care. Or you have existing children. And so even though you are desirous of having this baby, you match it up with the rest of your life and you see that it's going to have tremendous costs and costs to the child itself. When in the second letter, you know, the woman said having the child would have brought her to homelessness. It would have brought her and her child to homelessness.
Yeah.
You know, but it also reminds me, there's an article called Right But the Wrong Thing to Do, which is, I think, and that's not exactly what this reader has. She really thinks it was, she doesn't think it was the wrong thing to do, but what she's regretting is not that she did it. She would do that same thing over again. She's regretting the circumstances that made it necessary for her to make that choice.
Yes.
And, you know, my view is that's why we have to have legal abortion, so that when a woman is in that place, the law is not working against her too.
Yes, exactly. And I also think it's so important, like, to me, what I hear in both of those stories is this clarity around making the decision, which I think is, it kind of runs as a counter story to the assumptions by legislators that people don't know. But at the same time, I think what's so interesting is, like, I've had a number of sex workers on the show, and one of the things that we've talked about at length is that because there's people who are so anti-sex work and really embedded in the human trafficking debates, that pro-sex work activists don't really have the luxury to invite nuance. So sex
right,
work is wonderful,
right.
It's empowered, it's something we choose, and that's not the whole story. And the nuance and where the power is ultimately gets lost. And we see that with pro-choicers versus pro-lifers in these conversations of, like, pro-choicers feel like they can't risk saying, I regret this, because pro-lifers will take that and run with it to the detriment of women and people accessing abortions.
That's right. And you see that in the way in the legal world, in that we never use the word baby. It's always a fetus. And that's not how women, you know, many women feel about it. They may well feel very connected. But the minute you say baby, it's like a concession to the right.
Yes.
Oh, so you admit it's murder. You admit you're killing a baby. And so that's why there's been this the rhetoric of it all has put a real stranglehold on being to get to the nuance. You're exactly right. The other thing is that the second letter brings up is you're not allowed to mourn. You're not allowed, and that's part of the punishment, I think. It's a way that it's part of the punishment of how the culture treats abortion. You know, maybe it's more subtle than we think, but we're sure not going to give you the opportunity to talk about it, mm-hmm. and to say why, you know, that you miss this person. Many women commemorate the date of the abortion, or usually the projected birth date of a child that isn't born. Mm-hmm. And there's this concept in sociology called disenfranchised grief. Mm. And it's like mourning for something that the society says you're not entitled to mourn for. And so some people feel this way about, like, oh, my dog died, I'll never be the same. Mm-hmm. No, don't be ridiculous. You can't love your dog like that. And many people applied it also to, in the, 20 years ago, to gay and lesbian couples, now it would apply to chances. Well, my partner died. And they'd say, well, that's not even a relationship. You can't mourn that person.
Yes.
And so this disenfranchising people from feeling the range of feelings they actually feel, one, because it's politically dangerous, and the other is that it's part of the punishment not to let you feel this way. Did you see the picture of the Japanese statues?
Yes, and I loved them.
Yeah, it's a ritual that is in some sects, some religious sects in Japan, where after a miscarriage or an abortion, which is interesting because they put them together, you can buy a little stone statue of a particular god who is the god of protecting children in the afterlife, and then you dress it up in baby clothes, and there are rows and rows of these in the gardens where these are. That's all that's there. And so you bring it little toys. You can bring it food. And what you're doing is you're saying, you're acknowledging that the fetus, I'll use the word that way, under that belief system had a soul, and the soul will get reborn, and you're wishing it well. You want it to have good, you know, a good afterlife, possibly be reincarnated. And I think lots of American women are jealous of that, that there's this thing you can do to say, I'm thinking of you. I'm sorry this happened. It's not an apology that you wouldn't do it again. Abortion is completely legal in Japan, and these rituals are not political. They're not used by pro-life people. They're just a way of accommodating, you know, the range of human emotion. It's the same thing for women who have children who get, you know, prenatal diagnoses that are like your child has conditions that are incompatible with life, which means it probably won't last the pregnancy, or it will die, you know, within hours of birth. So those are wanted pregnancies, and they're declined for another reason, that it's part of it is maternal health. Part of it is the well-being of the child. Mm-hmm. So it's only, there's never anything good thought. There's never thought to be a good motive for having an abortion. Mm-hmm. And we know that there are.
Yes. And I think too, just recognizing one, the hierarchy that exists within so many of these very complicated decisions that we make, you know, like when we compare miscarriages with abortion, both are the ending of a pregnancy, but because one is a choice, then we can punish and vilify it. But then even within abortion, you know, to terminate because of a result of rape, to terminate because of like imminent fetal death or imminent maternal death.
Yes.
Those are handled somewhat differently depending on the circles you're talking to, but kind of in a general sense, those are handled differently than I had an abortion because I didn't want to be pregnant.
Yep. And so those are the first category, or those are the good abortions. Mm-hmm. And so when you're working in this area, you have to be really careful that you don't always use so-called good abortions for your examples, because happily, most women aren't raped, you know? Yes. I mean, that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. But we're very reluctant to take, I don't want to be pregnant. Except if you look at the narratives and stories that women who had abortions before 1973, when it became legal in the U.S., they were just full of relief. I mean, it's a very different approach than what we have now, where we have so much attention to the fetus and such a strong pro-life movement, and which is now sitting, you know, in Washington.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And going back to those statues in Japan,
yeah,
that particular religious sect, you know, one of the things that struck me when I read that part of the book, I actually put it down, and my husband and I had like an hour-long conversation about this exact thing. And that, for me, I found that beautiful because it was permission to create a ritual around your experience and your feelings. And I think that's so missing for women in the United States who have to keep the secret, who have to hide it, who have to kind of just push it down because they feel like their reason wasn't valid enough, or because their grief in whatever magnitude it is not something that they feel like they should be carrying. And I loved just the opportunity for people who have ended a pregnancy to be able to say, here are all my thoughts about it. Here's my feelings. And here's a representation of that so that I can revisit if I need to, or I can just have this moment and then release it. And I just feel like that's so much more liberating and healthy for folks who go through this process. And some people may not need the ritual, but I think just having the option to have that ritual and to have it be seen is pretty powerful.
Well, I agree with you. And I keep saying, in talking about this book, I'm not saying abortion is not compulsory. Talking about abortion is not compulsory. Having a ritual, you don't have to do it, but it should be there because these are the we offer it for every other aspect of life. We recognize that people have strong emotional needs, and this concerns, you know, a decision not to have a child. And I was thinking about the first letter, the second letter you read, where the woman had she said she was in a dark mental place. Mm-hmm. So that's also really important that women can recognize they, for their own current problems of sort of mental health, might not to be able to be the kind of mother they want. Mm-hmm. And that person that who wrote that letter, she said she was caring for a younger brother as well. So it isn't that women are like sitting around on a, you know, a float in a pool eating bonbons. I mean, I know very few such women, and they're taking care of people. That's what women do. Or they're taking care of themselves, and that's what women should do.
Yes.
And that's the harder part often, you know, to do something. That's the harder part to explain because we're not supposed to be selfish.
Well, and for me, that ties so closely to the work that I do here on the podcast in that, you know, I've received thousands of questions from people over the years of doing this podcast. And one of the things that comes up over and over and over again is specifically with women who are writing in feeling like they can't take up the space to say they don't like something, not knowing what pleasure looks like for them, because they've just been doing what they thought they were supposed to, feeling ashamed that they can't orgasm or feeling ashamed that they need to use a vibrator, for instance. There's this kind of chronic, and of course we know it's because of patriarchy and misogyny, but there's this like chronic space that I find for women who are in pain of feeling like, to actually say, these are the things that I need would be selfish rather than would be caring of self, which is important. And like, I see that exact thing echoing here in these conversations around ending a pregnancy.
Yeah.
It's selfish.
And selfish and shameful.
Yeah.
So, you know, to talk about pleasure or self, taking care of oneself and learning how to do that is you're right. It's selfish, but I would add in that anything to do with the body, women are taught pretty early not to talk about and keep it secret. And I was sort of thinking about this the other day, was reading some stuff on the development of girls' breasts. And that's when women or girls begin to stoop over. To hide them, and if you move from breasts to your period, I mean, maybe it's different now. Maybe young women are bolder about this, and then you go from periods to sex, then you go to on the range, possibly miscarriages, possibly childbirth, and then you come to menopause. And boy, you really don't want to talk about that. Mm-hmm. I mean, that might be a good program for you.
Yes.
But it's this whole chronology of a woman's reproductive life, and at each step, you keep it to yourself. Mm-hmm. So it's no surprise that on the details of, you know, orgasm, keep it to yourself, or on the details of why this wasn't the right time to have a child. Mm-hmm. That the secrecy that overlays the whole the whole discussion, and it's one of the reasons why the right controls the narrative. You know, they can say you made that decision on a whim. So far, nothing you've read out so far sounds whimsical to me. You know, it all sounds like deep thinking and a bit of suffering as well. Mm-hmm. So that the letter that said, you know, I don't want my reasons to become fodder for the pro-life movement.
Yeah.
That really hits it, because as long as other women – and so that's – it requires you to be a bit brave to stand up and say, I had an abortion because – and the becauses are so – They're varied, but they are all. But very few women have abortions for convenience. That's the allegation. You know, you had an abortion for it just wasn't convenient for you.
Right.
Nothing you're reading sounds that way.
Not at all. And I think what's clear in all of the stories, and of course, the stories that don't make it into this part of the episode will be on our website, and all of them make it very clear. And there are a few stories that got shared where the people said, I was really grateful I had this choice because it was just not right for me. And so people who are just like very vehemently grateful
yes.
and clear in their gratitude and don't have kind of this sense of loss or regret as part of their story. But I think leaving space for all of the range of experiences from I do regret having to make this choice, and it was a huge sense of loss, and I will mourn this for the rest of my life, all the way across the spectrum to, this was great. This is exactly what I needed in order to keep my life being my life on my terms, and I'm glad I had this option and to do it safely. You know, there's so many millions of smaller versions in between those two, and I think, like, The core of your book is about secrecy, and to have these stories shared is such an important part of changing the political landscape. And I think specifically for listeners who feel like, well, I haven't had an abortion, or I don't know anyone who's had an abortion, why is this relevant to me? You know, when we're talking about privacy versus secrecy, this impacts so many different parts of our private lives, in that so many people who are kinky have to be secret because they would be fired.
Yes.
They would be ostracized. They would be cut out of communities and families. The same for polyamorous and non-monogamous folks. Losing access to money or losing financial and family support. And even for lots of folks who are queer, gay, lesbian, trans, certainly, you know, the secrecy is about not really having the choice to disclose in a safe way. And we see those exact same themes happening here around abortion. And I loved that what your book talks about is, if we start talking about our experiences like we did with gay marriage, like we did with cancer, which used to be super hush-hush,
right?
Then we start influencing greater circles of people, which becomes public, and then that ultimately influences the political at that higher level.
That's right. And it keeps the single narrative from prevailing. Mm-hmm. And so I've thought, I have this, I mean, I'm a law professor and not I don't lead an activist campaign, but I'm warming up to the idea. And I think that this idea of talking, so in my little action program, I have three groups that I think should start stepping up and saying they had an abortion. And my friends criticize me and say, you're a coward with your little three groups, but here they are. The first is grandmothers. So I think grandmothers are really good to speak out on this because, first of all, in a cruel way, grandmothers are thought to be non-sexual anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you at least get rid of the sex issue, which politically is good.
Mm-hmm.
So you have someone who's, you know, it's pretty hard to call a grandmother, you know, whimsical.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one group. The second group are ministers' wives.
Ooh.
Don't you think?
Yes.
I think that there's a group with moral authority, or ministers themselves, now that we have women, you know, in the pulpit sometimes. Not to be not to brag about it, but simply to have that in there, to be able to speak about it, to be able to lead a discussion group, to be able to say it was a hard decision or it wasn't a hard decision, or, you know. And the third group is men. And I think it would be just really good if men took a little responsibility here about causing a pregnancy, about, you know, there are some pro-life websites where men can go to discuss how harmed they were by the abortion. Mm-hmm. And that's not really what I have in mind, you know, because there are a lot of forgiveness websites now.
Yeah.
And by the way, the Pope has also said that, and this is a very good thing, I think, that priests should forgive and absolve women who come and say they've had an abortion. And some people say, well, that's not that good because they have to say they're sorry for it. You know, you have to ask for forgiveness, which suggests you've done something wrong. But I think for women who have certain beliefs, it's certainly better than the way the Catholic Church has behaved in the past.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm for this guy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I sort of lost my train there.
Well, I think on specifically men stepping up
men.
And taking responsibility, you know, we definitely need men to step up and take responsibility in so many arenas around like sexual assault and consent. But I think to abortion, you know, one of the statistics in your book is that 1/3 of American women will have abortion by the time they're 45. So statistically speaking, we all know someone.
That's the thing. I went to an all-women's college, and it was in the 70s, so, you know, it's a while ago. But I remember I was at a reunion sitting with three other women, and I said, you know, it's so funny. We went to an all-women's college, and I never knew a single lesbian or a person who had an abortion. And the three other women looked at me. Like, I mean, you can picture their faces. It was just... It was poor Carol, you know, of course, and they didn't need to say any more. And I said, oh, God, of course, yes. And so it's that. And the thing that I would push is that if you found out that a cousin had an abortion of any age, what would you do? Would you stop being friends with your cousin? You know, and I have to believe the answer is no, we don't. It doesn't define who you are. You know, you don't become a murderer because you had an abortion. You know, you don't become a vile person. You are still the person you were, and you took action that you thought was right at a particular point in your life. It's not, you know, it's not an overarching identity having had an abortion.
Right.
You don't walk around, it's not like the Scarlet Letter.
Right.
You know, she was an adulteress. I guess it's an A word also. So we don't have, it doesn't work the same way, or it shouldn't, but there's the fear that it will. And the fear is not unfounded. People get punished for having abortions. I mean, they lose, you know, you've given some good examples. So we have to have a little bravery in all this stepping up that I'm talking about. And I don't, a former student said to me, who are you to tell women they have to take on more responsibility? Or she put it nicer than that. But she said, you're sounding a little bit like Sheryl Sandberg. You want women to lean in after they've made this decision and, you know, hidden it from their families. And now you want them to take the burden, the risk of speaking up. And I said, I don't want every woman to do it. I think women have to appreciate their circumstances and know when they can and when they can't. But the second letter that you read, that woman seemed to do it incrementally. For she told some close friends. Then she told her mother. Another letter said that the writer told her present partner. Mm-hmm. And so you can just practice, you know, I think that's it. You can practice telling someone and see if the ceiling collapses on you.
Yeah.
And I think that it won't. I think so. I'm not calling for recklessness, although, Lindy West and Amelia Bono, you know, shout your abortion. They say, just get out there and yell it. And I admire that. I'm just, that might not be for everyone.
I would love to read one more story as we kind of move towards the end of the interview, if you're up for that.
I'd love it.
Okay. So Colleen had an abortion at 23. I got pregnant on the best weekend of my entire life. It was on a camping trip with a bunch of friends, and I had reconnected with an old boyfriend from high school after not seeing him for a few years. There was not any talk of renewing our relationship. We both understood it was just a moment in time. Afterward, when I found out I was pregnant, I cried and cried. I knew I was going to terminate because I was a few weeks away from starting university. It was still very difficult, even though I knew what I needed to do. I never told my old boyfriend because I felt like telling him would be cruel when I was already firm in my decision. We were not part of each other's lives, and we lived in different cities. Afterward, I had a difficult time dealing with what happened. I started to get angry that I was having to deal with the consequences by myself when I sure as hell didn't get pregnant by myself. I had the urge to tell him because part of me was resentful that he had the luxury of being oblivious. A friend of mine talked me out of telling him, and I'm glad I didn't. The anger eventually passed. I made peace with it. I got married years later to someone I met in college, and I'm so thankful that I gave myself the freedom to go. It was the absolute right decision that I have never regretted. I ended up having a child much later who was amazing in every way. I catch myself sometimes doing the math in my head, like when I was 41 and realized that that first child would have been graduating. During these moments, I thank the universe for the life and family that I have, and I send intense love to that first child who I choose to believe went on to be born to a mother who was ready and all in like I was when I eventually had my daughter.
That's a very beautiful letter. I mean, that is really striking, and it shows so many things. I mean, one is sort of the range of emotions she experienced. And so, but the anger at not being able to do it.
Yeah.
And of course, she was shouldering the whole burden. I mean, the man did have the luxury of oblivion. But can you read the part at the very end where she says, "And I think about the child that wasn't born."
Yes, I ended up having a child much later who is amazing in every way. I catch myself sometimes doing the math in my head, like when I was 41 and realized that that first child would have been graduating. During these moments, I thank the universe for the life and family I have and send intense love to that first child who I choose to believe went on to be born to a mother who was ready and all in, like I was when I eventually had my daughter.
Well, I want to say I'm really proud to witness that sentence, you know, and I'm glad that it's in your program because it shows a way of respecting the child that wasn't born and regarding it that way as one of her children, a sort of special child that she knows about, that, you know, she has. Her letter made me think is how the non-birth of one child can make another child possible.
Yes.
And that's, we don't really think about it that way, but I think that's probably often the case. You know, you're older, you're smarter, you're with the right person.
Mm-hmm.
We don't think about abortion as the opening of possibility.
Yeah.
And that, maybe subliminally we do, but that was really great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I love, you know, one of the things you talk about in the book is that another area where there's a lot of shame and secrecy is around HIV and AIDS. And it's both HIV AIDS and abortion are seen as the result of choices that you've made. And so we can like personally vilify you for having these sexually shameful secrets and actions. But what I don't hear in a lot of these letters is shame. I mean, I hear loss, grief, confusion, anger, But definitely there is some shame in some ways, but it's less about shame around the abortion and maybe shame more around having to hide it, do it alone, feeling like people won't understand. And I think that's important, especially with this last letter of this decision was right for her and she weighed these things, but it has yielded a life that is rich with a healthy daughter that she loves and is all in with, in her own words. And, you know, there's nothing to be ashamed of in that sphere to me.
No, I think that's exactly it. And then it's a wonderful phrase, all in. Mm-hmm. And the opposite, you know, having to be all in or having to have a child that you're not all in with because your life isn't all in yet. You know, it's really a very cruel thing. We used to use the phrase involuntary motherhood, which is what it will be what it will be for poor women if Roe is overturned. And I think that we're in such a perilous moment right now.
Yes.
With regard to this. And I, you know, it's kind of mind-boggling. Every time I meet an old friend, she says, "Are we talking about the things we talked about 40 years ago? How can that be? And I said, it can't be. We can't let it be. Because we can't go back to those days of you know, dangerous, illegal self-abortions. And the disrespect that it means.
Yeah.
That's it's not just that you're wrecking someone's life. And it doesn't mean that everyone who has a child they don't want has a terrible life.
Right.
I mean, some women for spiritual reasons or whatever reason might prefer to have an abortion and doesn't, and maybe their life isn't ruined.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe it all turns out well. But that's not a roll of the dice we want to hand women.
Yeah.
You know, we think that you should have control over the prior part of that. Should I have this child or not? And so I'm banking that there's going to be some movement to take away contraception.
Yes.
Sort of a return to the culture of life.
Yes.
Meaning life in the pro-life sense. And it's very scary. And so that's why I think I'm just so glad you're having this program now so that people can think about talking as actually political action.
Yeah.
Just telling someone is actually turning yourself into someone who's in this small way improving the conversation, changing it a little bit. Everyone who has an abortion isn't the terrible person that the right suggests it is. We're all in on this,
right? We're all doing our best.
That's it. I want everyone to do their best.
Yes.
I wrote the book, you know, that was really hard and it took a lot of years. And so I'm so glad that it has at all the effect I hoped, which was just to reflect a little bit on how, if you feel ashamed and you feel, you know, you have to keep everything secret, you should know that there's a whole apparatus of law trying to make you feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, trying to making you feel sneaky, making you wait 48 hours because you're too dumb to know what an abortion is after you consent, making you bury the remains and all of that. That's purposeful stuff. It's meant to keep things secret.
Yeah.
And that's what we have to kind of bust open.
Yeah. So there's one last little it was a single sentence in your book that I just want to kind of throw out really quickly before we wrap up. You know, so many of my listeners are queer or non-binary or trans or know people who are. And we have throughout this hour used very binary, heterocentric language of men
and
women.
Yes, it's true. Yes.
And there is a sentence in chapter one where you acknowledge that not everyone who has an abortion is a woman, but for the sake of navigating these very complex conversations, you ascribed male gender to certain characters in the book, like judges, and you ascribed female pronouns and women to folks who receive abortions. And I loved that you named that. I mean, the truth is the vast majority of abortions are chosen by women or people who identify as women, but not all. And the fact that you just had that one little sentence in parentheses in chapter one just like warmed my inclusive little heart to just like name that.
Well, my pleasure. That's great.
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to read it?
Oh, yes. Let me do that. It says in parentheses, well, let me read the sentence before it just to give it a little context. So it says, if he finds she is not sufficiently mature, he rejects the petition and the immature minor marches on to motherhood. And so you were talking about judges finding girls mature and granting petitions around abortion. And then in parentheses, I use the masculine pronoun for judges and others throughout to avoid pronoun confusion, since most pregnant persons are female.
Yes, that was, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, that is something I think that you put right at the beginning of the book, and I think it's so important to name in that, we live in a patriarchal culture that's, you know, rape culture and misogyny left and right. And so the truth is women, whether they're cis women or trans women, are much more likely to be the victims of violence and discrimination and all sorts of things. But I think just naming that in that one sentence was so important of, well, not everyone who has an abortion is a woman, but we really need to focus this around the current systems.
Yes. Well, thank you. I'm glad you noticed that. I'm really pleased. But, and you're right. I do keep it pretty binary, in part because the people who I want to read this also are binary thinkers. So I wanted to not make it too hard, but I did want to acknowledge that life is more interesting these days.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show, Carol. I'm wondering, do you have a website or social media that you'd like to share with people, or should we just tell people where they can get the book?
Oh, well, I guess I'm on Twitter. Mm-hmm. And it's Carol Sanger NYC.
Great.
And that would be lovely.
Okay.
And you can get the book online. And I've been making a big fuss with the publisher, asking them to please put it out in paperback so it won't be. But you can, there, I've seen it slightly discounted online. So that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So the title.
A group can buy one and pass it around.
Oh, yeah. Do that with book clubs and stuff.
Yeah.
So just for everybody who's listening, the title is About Abortion: Terminating Pregnancy in 21st Century America. I will have links to Carol's Twitter and a link to check out the book through Harvard University Press so that everyone can check it out. And also, please ask your libraries to carry this book. Carol and I were talking about this before we started recording, about how valuable and important it would be for young people to be able to just peek at this book and reference it at the library without having to bring it home and hide it. Access is important, and you have to ask for books like this at most libraries. So please ask them to get it.
That's great. Is there time to say one more thing?
Yeah.
So there's a wonderful young woman who wrote a review of the book on Rewire. Her name is Katie Claybush, and she starts it out by saying, "This is the best book on abortion I didn't know I had to read."
I completely agree with that. Dozens, and I agree.
Yeah, I thought that was really nice. So, yeah, there's always more stuff to learn.
Yes. I will also link to that Rewire article. So if you all want to head to, sexgetsreal.com for this episode, you can find all of Carol's information, access to the book, and also that Rewire article if you want a kind of a recap of the book before you decide to jump in.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
And I just want to say, it is so easy to talk to you, and I'm so happy that you invited me on the program.
Oh, thank you so much. I will admit, I was so nervous before we hopped on. I've interviewed like hundreds of people, but I was just so blown away by your book that I was like, oh, I want to impress Carol.
You have. And you know what? I have the exact same. I was sitting here in the same feelings. I thought, oh my God, she's so great. So we should just reward each other. It was great.
Well, thank you so much, Carol. And of course, thank you to everyone who listened. If you have listened and you have an abortion story that you would like to share, I would love to hold space and receive that. Of course, if you have thoughts or questions about this episode or anything that you'd like me to cover down the road, go to sexgetsreal.com and use the contact form. There is an anonymous option, so feel free to share those stories and those questions, because I would love to share them on future episodes. So until next time, I'm Dawn Sarah with Carol Sanger on Sex Gets Real. Bye.